Welcome to Leader Insider Secrets, where we get to the source of success. Hear from leaders who bear all and share their insider secrets, along with my episodes aimed at optimizing your performance, productivity, success, and well-being. Hi, my name's Estelle Reed at B.Company, and I'm an executive coach, trainer, and author of Inner Brilliance, Outer Shine, which explores 10 antidotes to imposter syndrome, workaholism, and stress. Okay, let's begin. Okay, welcome everybody. I have got Matt Truartha with me. Yay! From Fisher German, one of my faves. He's a partner and he's been a partner there since April 2013. And he's a property manager and consultant for large corporate and private clients, which involves proactively managing property assets on behalf of clients to maximize income, optimize opportunities, reduce risks, protect the capital value of the asset and remove distraction to allow the owners to captain their industry. I loved that bit. I thought that was dead good. But also protect their heritage or simply enjoy their time. One of the most precious gifts, isn't it? Time. We're all short of it. Now, I have known Matt probably about 4 years, really, when we first did an event together, a team event. But my experience of him is that you never forget him when you meet him. And I can remember being in the room with him, and he's just one of those unforgettable characters who has a really strong presence, but he's really tenacious, he's innovative, he's got an amazing mind, always coming up with creative ways of doing things differently. And as I said, he makes a great first impression. Even more so last Wednesday when we did an event together. He was very statesman-like. I know he's going to be wincing when I say all of this, but it was one of the best keynote speeches that I've ever seen. It was so authentic, honest, and real. But we'll maybe get into that speech a little bit later on, because I'm keen to know what enabled that star performance that we saw there. So, welcome. How are you, sir?
Very well, thank you. Very well, good morning.
Good morning. So we tend to kick this off with a quick fire round, in inverted commas, because it never is a quick fire round. But just so that people can get to know you, really. So when you, just to give the audience an idea of a day in the life of, did you ever do one of those essays at school? A day in the life of, I had to do a day in the life of a basketball. It was very strange. But if we could have a day in the life of Matt Truartha, what would that be like? What's your average day like?
I don't think I have an average day. It typically starts at, so between 5:30 and 6:00, I'll get up, depending on how I feel and what the weather's doing, go out with the dog, deal with the chickens. Usually there's laundry to deal with. We have a very, you know, back to front, let's say, relationship in our house. My wife does all the DIY and I do all the laundry.
That's cool.
Sorry?
That's really cool. I love that.
Her nickname is DIY Dave. So it's complete traditional role reversal. And then depends. If she's working at home, she will deal with the kids. I'll try and be in the office for sort of 7:00. If she's actually working in the office, she'll get up and leave at 6:30 to get to Coventry. And then so I'll do the school run at 7:30, drop them, literally pushing through the door at 7:28 and in the office 10 minutes later. I typically try and finish about 10:15 to 6:00. I like to be home for 6:00. And that's sort of the start of the bedtime routine. They're in bed and asleep before 7:00, and then it's kind of our time. And that's what goes on in between is just who knows.
Yeah. So are you office based? Are you out and about seeing clients, or how does it work?
It's a mix. I'm much more office based than I used to be. But I might be out a day a week. Depends what's going on and where it's going on and what I need to deal with. Obviously, I'm based up in Ashby, but I also look after the office down Exeter. So I'm down there every couple of weeks. I'm trying to get around all our other offices as well, just to see the people in our division. And because of the nature of the work, we're looking after national portfolios. I can be, you know, I could be down in Kent 1 week, and I could be up in Cumbria the next. It all depends what's going on and where's needed.
Yeah, nice. And it's interesting to know you've got chickens. My sister had two rounds of chickens. She lives in Spain. But Mr. Fox got them twice, and they tried various contraptions. So what's the secret to keeping chickens?
We've got a fully enclosed run, so they're locked in and secure. And then when we built it, we put a skirt of chicken wire all the way around the edge. So actually, if Mr. Fox comes, he can't actually dig in and go underneath. So they've been absolutely fine. There's also an electric fence around it to keep the cows off, which will deter the fox as well.
You're painting such an idyllic picture.
It's all right. It's all right. They went off the lay back in the winters. We had no eggs for weeks, and they were heading towards the Sunday lunch. But anyway, they're back up to full tilt again now.
How many do you have?
Got 8.
Lovely. Many years ago, we had to look after somebody else's chickens, and I love that going in the morning. You know, when getting the warm eggs, it was like finding treasure. But then we got up one morning and I don't think we'd shut the doors properly. There's still some left.
Oops.
Oops, yes. So what's your obsession outside of work?
Oh, what God. What do I obsess about?
Or just enjoy spending time doing. Do you have any hobbies or anything like that?
Oh God, no, not really. I like to read. I like books, particularly light books, and anything that gives me a couple of hours just to read is always good. Two children, that's really the biggest hobby, I suppose. That's the time, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, absolutely. And where did your love of books come from? When did you get into books?
Not long ago, I don't think. I suppose my original books were just your typical crime novels that I would read, and I might get into a series of those and just, you know, just keep going and going and go right through the series. But I would have been mid-30s probably. And then I don't know why, a few years ago I bought what is still my favourite book, and it's called Library, A World History, and it's a book all about the greatest libraries in the world.
Yeah.
The photographs are absolutely stunning. And it's this great big hardback book. And I absolutely love it. And that's kind of what then triggered me into reading, you know, more informational books, if you like. I don't really know how to describe them, but, you know, I'll read a lot about artists and that kind of thing. Yeah. And then I then got into audiobooks 3-4 years ago. I'd always been an absolute staunch. Now, if it's, I've got a book, I want a book on a piece of paper in my hand that I'm going to bloody read.
Yeah.
And I got into audiobooks, and I got into audiobooks because I got a free one. You get a free credit, and there's an audiobook I wanted to listen to, so I did. And it kind of snowballed from there.
Yeah.
And so it's that's kind of the other obsession. I'd never get in the car without it. They're always on. Out walking the dog, they're always on.
Yeah. I'm visual, so I struggle with... I got an Audible subscription because I thought I ought to have one. And also I used it as an opportunity, you know, to listen to books that I thought, I'm not prepared to buy that book. So it was a bit of an experiment. So take, for example, I listened to, looking around at my bookcase, Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, yep. Whatever it is. And I'm not one on following trends. I'm a bit of a bugger like that. If everybody's doing something, I like to do the opposite. And actually, I listened to it and it was really good and I learned loads and I thought, what a stubborn arse, should have listened to it sooner. So that was how I kind of dipped my toe in the water. But then I listened to more technical books and I got frustrated because I need to be making notes or highlighting. Are you a highlighter? In books, do you highlight stuff?
No, God, no, absolutely not. No, That'd be sacrilege. I can't even begin with a creased spine. If I, if my wife borrows one of my books and she will purposefully bend the spine so she can read it, I just have to go buy a new one. It's not going back on the shelf with the creased
spine.
Oh, yeah. That's a bit of a problem. I tend to, it's interesting. I'll listen to some. And actually, I think what I've learned recently is that there's quite a lot of, well, there's thousands of books out there. There's quite a lot with a theme, and this is the idea, and this is the concept, and that's great. But actually, they spread it out to 8 hours. And actually, I'm gonna do a bit of an experiment. And actually, I'm only gonna listen to the first half of every book, because actually, what you find is, and your book is different, I hasten to add, but actually, you get to the point where actually they're just banging the same drum repeatedly for 8 hours. And actually, so if you get the idea in the first 4 hours, I'm gonna put it down and move on to something else, because actually, I'm just wasting time.
Yeah. No, that's and that explains why I half read books, because I get really excited about a concept and then I tend to get bored. And it's interesting that you say that, because I was determined when I wrote my own book that I didn't want to do that. I wanted it to be different and for every slice to be different. Yep. But interestingly, I got one of my first professional reviews through the other day, and I was a bit like, oh, and it was a really good review, very honest, but one of the things that got on her nerves was the fact that I kept mentioning Haveney. So that was one of the things. But it's actually, do you remember when we were talking about speeches a few weeks ago, and I spoke about leaving open loops?
Yeah.
So it's an NLP technique, so neuro-linguistic programming. So you leave a teaser and you keep teasing it out, and then you close the loop, so you keep people engaged by, you know, slotting little bits in. And I'd done this unconsciously throughout the book, but it got on the nerves. But no, she liked the fact that everything was backed by saying, so that was good. So I was pleased about that. Anyway, sorry, go on. What were you going to say?
Nothing. Go on.
So this series two is focused around the topics of my book, Inner Brilliance, Outer Shine, 10 Antidotes to Imposter Syndrome, Workaholism and Stress, and soon to be released at Long Flipping Last, 25th of March, 2022. And Matt was one of my very first book readers. And I gave him a copy of the book. I only had a few, but I gave him a copy because I knew he would appreciate it and I knew he would read it, because I'd seen your posts on LinkedIn and I knew you were an avid reader. So the questions are centered around the chapters in the book. And chapter one is about knowing your coordinates, because the book itself is a process. So you are taking... So what I do is I take you through a process, and the process is the process I use with my clients. And I won't necessarily use all the process, but if you go from start to finish, the idea is you will shine at the end. And the first step in any change is to know where you're at, so to know your coordinates, because if you don't know where you are currently, how the hell can you decide where you want to journey towards or move towards? So we did a really exciting project, didn't we, last week? Or I was like fever pitch excited anyway, last week. So that was one of the things I noticed that was exciting. But for you, what's happening right now in work? What are you excited about or challenged by?
Oh gosh, challenged every day. I'm excited to actually, you know, because obviously last week we did a day about line managers and how we could be better line managers and look after people better. So I'm excited about that, because I think that's the absolute cornerstone of our business. And I think we have some big challenges there. And it shouldn't be that difficult, really. It should be pretty easy wins. It's common sense. It's acknowledging that we're not great at it, but actually this is what we need to do. So I think that's quite exciting. So I think that will it will improve the whole flow of the business, you know, and forget about profitability and all those kind of things. But actually, if it improves the way we work, it improves the way we just communicate with each other, it improves the level of happiness, you know, we reduce our need for recruitment, we actually keep the hub together. And I think that will just drive us so much further, so much quicker. You know, we've got some stuff to deal with. We do need to look at our sort of professional development and our future skills. That's really important. And actually we've been in a very stuck profession for a long time. This is the standard career path. This is the qualification you must get at this point. Da, da, da. And actually it's kind of, in my mind, it's now redundant, and we're just going to fall behind. And so actually it's taking that and going, all right, well, we've taught you the basics. That's dead easy. Actually, we need a much bigger world view, you know, much wider topic. If you understand the world, you understand your job. You understand how your job's changing. So there's all sorts to do there. You know, we do have some trust issues in the business, and we need to break that down. And we need to get under the skin of actually where that comes from and why it's there.
What do you think the key is to building trust in an organization?
Honesty. It's putting the organization before the individual. And it's really difficult, because it only takes one action, one comment to actually completely undermine all that. So we've got to be really mindful about it. We've got to be very good at our communication. We've got to be very careful in our communication. You know, we've got to deal with gossips and naysayers. And we kind of have problems, I think, at the minute where, and it was brought up, it was captioned very well last week, where the more information you give people, the more they expect. And so if you suddenly don't tell them one thing, you've told them 99, you don't tell them the one thing, what are you hiding?
Yeah.
And I think partly we are very open, we are very transparent about virtually everything. But actually, are we too open? Do we tell people too much? Are we overloading them? Are we providing too much information? Too regular? Is not enough? Is it in the right format? You know, and I've came around to the idea of, you know, information grazing, and actually, how do we give people just tiny little bite-sized bits of information without giving them reams of text? Mm. You know, and actually, I think we also need to acknowledge that people absorb information in different ways. So, you know, you're visual, I'm quite audible. Mm. So actually for me, just to listen to Andrew Bridges' vlog once a month, I'd have to have the screen on, I can just listen. That's really good for me. Actually, other people might just like to read just a scrolling word across a screen while they're making a coffee. It's how do we what information do we have? What do we actually need to give? How do we make sure it's disseminated through all four parts of the business equally in it the right way? Because what I'm finding is that, you know, one part of the business will be communicating down very well, and then somebody sitting in another part of the business in the same office is going, well, I didn't hear that. Mm. And so we've got all sorts of things that we need to deal with. Right. And it's symptomatic of us being large. And actually, yeah. You know, the next time that we have a merger, or, you know, I'm sure we've got 30 or 40 vacancies at the minute, so we're growing all the time. How on earth do we communicate properly and effectively without killing people with information?
Mm. And it's not just information that creates trust, though, is it? It's those everyday interactions we have with people. And one of the examples I always use is, it's a bit like, you know, being a politician. Do you believe what's being communicated by that person based on their non-verbal tells?
Yep.
Do they look congruent? So in other words, is everything lining, is their body language lining up with what's coming out of their gob? Or is there something that's a bit insincere about what's been said? So there's, and I think trust goes broader in terms of, it's things like keeping a promise, isn't it? If you say you're going to do something, and if you think about the whole day last week, how it was structured, you were really keen to say, look, we're not going to just pay lip service to this thing. We're going to have a plan, and we are going to actually take action. And then it requires a leadership team to deliver on that action, doesn't it? And follow through on those promises. But I think it's also things like competence inspires trust as well. Competence as a leader, as a manager, in individuals. I had an interaction with somebody that I was going to be taking on service-wise, and my trust has been damaged because they've not delivered on some promises. And you start to question competence then, as well. So yeah. I think it's a complex thing, isn't it, trust?
It is. And I think, you know, you can have somebody who acts in a certain way all of the time, and then on one day they say something and you go, well, I can't believe you, because, you know, for the last year you've been acting in this way, and I know tomorrow you'll act in this way. And so there's quite a disconnect in actually how we act and how we think. And until I think we kind of need to come together and go, this is a partnership, we are in this together, and so we're all part of it, and that partnership isn't just the partners, it's the entire business. And so, and actually, if we all work together, the whole thing grows for everybody. It's the rising tide lifts all boats thing.
Yeah.
And it's how we manage. That's it's an impossible one to manage, perhaps. But
all of that aside, as I say, I mean, I've dipped into many cultures, you know, over the years, 16 years worth of consultancy. And Fisher German is a special business. You know, you really do have some amazing people. There's something about an FG person, you know, when you meet one, and, you know, there is something that, I don't know, I am biased, I do love your business. And I think when I do a compare contrast, I think it's great, the plan that you've got together that we're going to be implementing, but I genuinely think it will be tweakings as well. No, it's a really good business. So I'm going to jump a few questions, because it is my next question. I might go backwards in a moment and talk about imposter syndrome in a bit, but because we were talking about last Wednesday, and I was saying earlier that the keynote speech that Matt gave last week was really, really powerful, in that he was statesman-like, he sounded authoritative, but also was really authentic and honest. And we've just been talking about trust, and we needed the team to be honest, didn't we, on that day? That was one of the things that you identified very early on, hence why, and we've got the Vox vote thing going, haven't we? And so that people could be honest, but confidentially. So what was it? So in my mind, you really shone. So when people shine, I talk about in chapter 4, aligning towards your stars. So it means that we're in line with strengths, with values, with purpose. And all of that stuff, when it's all aligned, people just seem to come alive. And you came alive last Wednesday, and you were a great example of a leader. And your message was really compelling. So what enabled that?
You know full well I don't like taking compliments. I don't know what enabled it. I get really nervous about public speaking. I don't, it's a bit perverse. I get really nervous. I don't want to do it. I don't want to stand up and I don't have to do it in front of people. When I'm doing it, I'm absolutely fine.
Yeah.
You know, and I can do it. And then by the time it comes around to the next time I have to do it, I've completely forgotten about that. And I'm all the way back to being completely terrified of doing it again.
And yet you didn't look terrified one bit. No, that's fine. These things happen. I think Matt was just going to be interrupted there for those.
I was the man checking the aircon. we'll cut that piece out.
No, but seriously, you didn't look nervous one bit. No, there wasn't even a quake in your voice. So what was it that inspired such a great speech? Where did that come from?
I suppose it just came from honesty. I just wrote it to be completely transparent, completely honest, and actually leave nowhere left to hide. And actually, you mentioned about, you know, the Vox vote and people being able to be honest but confidentially.
Yeah.
And to me, that's a serious issue. Yeah. That's a real issue in our business. If we don't feel that we can be honest openly, we have to express an opinion through a suggestion box or a Vox vote, then we have some fundamental issues, and that really needs breaking. And so when I wrote the people strategy, I wrote it with the intention that everybody in the division would read it, because it's for them, and they they need to see it. They need to know that it is not, it's not a tick box. It's not just being done for the sake of it. There is meaning behind it. And I think really the kind of the speech of the line managers just really need to reflect that. And it did kind of come out very, very honest.
But, you know, it takes time for people to be honest, doesn't it? And it's creating that, you know, back to trust again. It's creating that safety for people. So in other words, if I'm honest, there are not going to be any consequences for my honesty. It's not going to affect my career or anything like that, or my bonus, or because again, typically that's what you see in organizations, that people are afraid to be honest because they are concerned about the consequences. So it's an interesting challenge, isn't it? But you know, again, when you look at Patrick Lencioni's model on teams, the foundation is always trust, get the trust right, and then the next levels will come from that. So yeah, it's going to be, I think it's an exciting challenge. And
it is a big challenge. And I don't just want to do down Fisher German about it. I'm sure every business has this, but actually if we can break this cycle of, you know, there being a lack of trust at all levels and in all different kind of areas, same as copying people in on emails. If we can break all that and break any mindset that actually if I say what I really think, it's going to affect my career or my bonus or anything like that, if we can do away with all that, then actually the whole thing just flies.
Yeah.
Because you then get 600 people who are fully engaged, who are fully able to challenge, to offer opinions. You know, those opinions might never get listened to or anything else, but actually there'd be some incredible ideas and thoughts out there. 600 people is a lot of people with 600 life experiences and skills and all this kind of thing. And to actually open their heads up and take it all out, the whole thing just explodes. It's just, it's limitless, but quite how we get there, I don't know. And I'm saying this is not just a Fisher German issue. I'm sure this is common in every business.
It is. Otherwise, you wouldn't have a model on it, would you, where trust is the foundation
for a
high-performing team. So we are going to take a backward step just for a moment. I want to go back to what I was saying at the start in terms of imposter syndrome. So the first question is, have you experienced imposter syndrome?
Yeah, Monday to Friday, I think. I think it's inherent in everybody. Most people, not everybody, most people, some people just have that built-in level of confidence. I think everybody's got imposter syndrome. Everybody kind of wonders, how the hell did I get here? You know, one of these days I am going to be found out. And that's it's difficult because I'm not the most technical person in the world. I don't have the technical knowledge that some of my colleagues have. But you know what? Those kind of things make me feel like an imposter. But then, you know, am I better at other things? It's kind of accepting your lane on the road. Actually, I'm not over there. I'm in this lane. This is what I'm good at. You're good at that, but you're not so good at this. And it's just
nice. I'm glad you listened. No, I'm really pleased you said that. And because comparison is such a, oh my goodness, it's such a terrible thing, isn't it, to compare yourself? And it's ridiculous. And just as you've said earlier, that you've got 600 people in the business and they'll all have unique abilities and skills. And if they were all skilled at exactly the same thing, you wouldn't be a great organisation, would you? If you could all do
No, it would be a production line.
Yeah. And how does imposter syndrome work for you? So how does it impact on you? When do you notice it?
I suppose it's partly, there's embarrassment, there's nervousness, there's a need to do more to prove. Is it to prove myself or prove to other people? I'm not really sure, but to prove that actually, you know, I'm not an imposter. And I think it's a treadmill. I'm not sure it ever stops until you can reach the point where you're absolutely 100% confident in yourself. And there's probably things now that I felt an imposter about, you know, 5 years ago that I don't now, but there'll always be something coming along. And so I suppose it's taking those things and going and actually dealing with them and processing them and parking them, and actually then something else will come along. So I don't think it's anything you ever cure. I think you can probably learn to manage it and to identify it, and acknowledging it is really the first step.
Yeah, absolutely. And I did a survey on LinkedIn just recently to identify what other people felt the triggers were for imposter syndrome. And the number one trigger was their inner critic. So in other words, how they talk to themselves. And if you work on the premise that 90% of our thoughts are negative and 80% are the same thought that we had the previous day, and that's why I recommend, you know, using the journaling process so that you can challenge your inner dialogue and you can start to give yourself an inner captain as opposed to an inner critic. But interestingly, the next trigger for people is a new role or task or activity. So you know how you were talking about, so years ago you might have felt like an imposter in relation to X activity, but now it's kind of part of your skill set, and so you're no longer, so that is yours. And one of the antidotes is to acknowledge your skills, your strengths, your achievements, and go, no, those are mine. And again, that can help dampen down imposter syndrome thoughts and that kind of stuff. But again, interestingly, so when we look at our inner dialogue comes from our past. So it's often somebody else's voice. It's been triggered as a result of a past childhood event as well. And so the more past events we can collapse by using something like havening, the less we're going to be re-triggered by that narrative in our head. Would you like to talk about your experience of havening, how you found it?
Yes, for you. what I would say, you know, and actually obviously I've read the book once and I've said to you I will read it again. Now I've got the worksheet, so I'm going to actually go through the proper process. Okay. But actually it fits very well with kind of the coaching sessions that we've done. And what I think, you know, what surprised me is actually these tiny little minor insignificant things in the past, you know, all the way back to when I was a child, you know, when pushed for an example, something pops in the head and it means absolutely nothing to me. I've not thought about it for 35 years.
Yeah.
But there it is. And it's going, well, that's a nonsense.
Yeah.
And it's strange that something that insignificant then is actually still perhaps causing me an issue today. And actually just by squashing it and putting it aside and go, yeah, that really was a nonsense once and for all. And then moving on. And it's bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre what appears in the mind.
Yeah, but again, it's that, you know, so we talk about 0 to 7 being the imprint period, the imprint period being we're like a sponge, we're learning about the life, the world, is it a safe place, am I competent, am I loved, am I liked, and as a result of those experiences, we're laying down our patterns, our beliefs, our emotional triggers for life, and sometimes that's where we get stuck because we're not aware that we're just being re-triggered back to that old stuff.
Yeah.
And we think that that's just part of our makeup and just who we are. And yet, you know, I've seen time and time again and experienced it personally. You know, I never use a technique with clients unless I've used it myself. And I have havened myself to death. You know, I've havened many things. you know, and as somebody who I used to get severe panic attacks, I used to have really bad anxiety. I couldn't do heights. I couldn't do lifts. And on my office wall, I've got a picture of me on a skiing trip. I'd forgotten I had an issue with lifts and heights. And of course, what do you do when you go skiing? You go in a high uplift. And I just booked the trip without thinking. And that's often what it can be like. I lost you for a minute then. You're back.
Yeah, did drop out. There we go. We're back.
Cool. Cool. So one of the impressions you gained when I started working with you is that you run a tight ship. That's chapter 7. And running a tight ship is about how we organize ourselves, how we manage our boundaries. You know, how do we manage this precious resource called time? Because you're doing that for your clients as well, aren't you? In that you're giving them time by delivering the service. So what time boundaries do you apply? How do you run a tight ship yourself?
I suppose I purposely stopped working at 6. Yeah. I've had a nasty habit of checking my phone at all hours, but you know, trying to break that with my bat phone.
Your bat explain the bat phone.
It was pointed out to me in a coaching session with a very good coach that actually I just needed to have a separate phone for me, and that was mine. And then actually this work phone that was just lived in my pocket. In my time it wasn't a constant distraction. And actually, you know, having emails on your phone, I can remember getting emails on my phone 10 years ago, 12 years ago, and I thought it was absolutely magic. It's actually been the biggest curse of my entire life.
Yeah.
And so actually just stopping, putting it down, leaving it alone. And actually I function so much better. You know, I don't work weekends. I refuse. I'll work late in the week if I need to.
Yeah.
But it's not the be all and end all. You're never going to be, on your deathbed, like, you know, you're never going to be pleased how many hours you worked.
Yes.
At all. And actually, nobody thanks you for working all those hours. Nobody thinks any more of you. And actually, as the world changes, as people change, actually, those people who work all hours and then tell you all about it are actually, that they're scoffed and scorned about. They're going, well, you bloody idiot. Actually, there is more to life. And I think what's hitting sort of age 40, and it's hard to believe, you kind of go, you know what, geez, I'm probably halfway through. And you don't, you know, you don't want to get to the end and go, oh God, I wish I'd done a bit more with myself.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the fear of regret, I think. And so, but you know, for me, I mean, I did used to work all hours. But actually, I was never, I could work till 10 o'clock tonight and I'll be absolutely hopeless tomorrow. And so I'm very much in a, almost in a child's routine of this is bedtime, this is get up time, this is work time, this is my time. And just because otherwise I just don't come back refreshed.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a time in my life where I had a notepad at the side of the bed because I would wake up in the middle of the night panicking about something I'd forgotten or needed to do. And I'd have to write it down to actually get it out of my head. Just so tomorrow morning, right, I've got a list, it's fine, I can go back to sleep. And that doesn't affect me any longer. I just, you know, I go to bed and I sleep. It's great.
That's great. You're a model of excellence. That's really cool. And, you know, you're so right about, in coaching, we have something called the deathbed question, where you take the client to their deathbed and you get them to reflect back to where they are now and, you know, what do they think about their life, what they learned. So if they carried on being that same person right up until their deathbed, what do they think about that? And it can be a real eye-opener for folk. And just what you said there, you could imagine, couldn't you, on the stone, something along the lines of, he lived a long life and he answered his emails very quickly.
Yeah.
Or, you know what I mean, he whatever it was, he worked really hard.
And left behind a load of money that he never enjoyed.
Yeah.
It's no point being the richest man in the cemetery.
Exactly. And, he didn't get time to spend with his wife or children or any of that, because they do grow up so quickly, don't they?
Yeah, not quickly enough. I mean, I'm just waiting for the day they actually get out and go to university and they're out of the house. But another 12 years with one of them and 14 with the other. see how soon the army can take them.
I don't know. So, so what do you do? So you've got, it sounds to me like, you've got really great structure that enables you to have off time. So how do you rest? How do you refuel? How do you recharge? What do you do to take care of your body? So this is chapter 10, which is accessing the mess deck.
Oh God. take care of my body. I can take
body or mind.
Body or mind. All right. Well, I mean, certainly during the last half of the final half of last year, I didn't take care of my body at all and I just packed the weight on. But I suppose just getting out of the house. I'm not great at sitting in the house all day. I like to go out and at least do something. I'd go places, see things. You know, I'll find something on a map just by chance. Oh, what's that? Oh, well, let's go and find that and just go for a walk, see something different. It may be an absolute nonsense, but just something to, you've just got to switch it off sometimes. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you know, I do like learning. I like reading, but actually it's got to be balanced.
Yes.
It's got to be balanced. And actually I've got to enjoy what I'm learning about.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know about you. I've got to be careful when I do my work reading, because it fires too many ideas sometimes.
Yeah.
Are you, and I know your mind has loads of ideas. So do you find that as well when you do your reading?
Yeah, it does. It triggers something. And I often think I might only take one thing away from a book. I'm learning about anthropology at the minute, just because it's completely different to anything I've done before, and just learning how culture is created and how it's carried forward, and it's stuff that I'd never ever thought about before.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that's, it's kind of talking about, you know, very old civilizations, but actually it's still relevant today, and how tribes of people began to communicate, and so how it's built into us. And you kind of talk about, you know, you kind of talk about drawing in the sand with a stick or painting on the cave of a wall, and that becomes grunts, and grunts become language. And then we've kind of had, 200,000 years of grunting at each other and creating these languages, to all of a sudden we've stopped speaking and we just email each other. And it seems ridiculous, but it's a fundamental flaw in how we're now doing business. Emails are great. You want to send something, great. But for crying out loud, and I try and drill this into everybody, you pick up the phone first. Oh, ideally, you've got a problem, you go and see somebody. Then you pick up the phone. Failing that, you send an email and say, can we have a chat about this? Because actually that we've destroyed that ability to communicate by hiding behind a keyboard. And that's a fundamental issue. And it's one thing that I think as a business we need to get over. I've completely lost track of where I was going.
No, we were talking about whether books stimulate thought. And I was interested that you were saying that you're learning about culture. And I was thinking, oh, I wonder what lessons you could connect back to Fisher German in terms of, are there any culture creating lessons that you've had from this book?
Because I'm not sure. This is going to sound silly. I'm not sure what culture is yet. I haven't rationalized in my mind whether culture is it kind of endemic? Is it just there? Is it created? How does it shift? Why does it shift? Where do you want it to shift? It seems kind of like a buzzword, but actually, even within Fisher German, with generally a good culture, actually there's different cultures in this team and this team and that room and this office and geographically. And so we talk about culture, and in my mind, I haven't yet bottomed out for myself actually what is culture, where does it come from. And I think until I kind of get that square in my own head, it's kind of impossible to sort of talk about it. Which sounds ridiculous, because I mean there's thousands of books on culture, but they all seem to come from their own experience. Or what's the culture of Google? What's the culture of Apple? Well, that's great. That's Google and that's Apple. That's not Fisher German. And actually, so what is our culture? Is it there? Is it already there? Or is it something that we're building, or are we changing it? And actually, if it's already there, where has it come from? And I think I haven't yet figured out where it's come from, what it is or where it's come from. And again, it kind of comes back to that anthropological sort of learning. Actually, you know, the culture travels around in our heads. You can't write it down. It's just, it's born into people. And as new people begin, it's kind of indoctrinated in them, if you like. So it's a funny one. We could spend all day on just talking about culture. Because maybe not yet, because I'm not ready. I haven't quite nailed it down yet.
But, you know, all those questions you asked, like, you know, where we're moving towards, does culture already exist? Yeah, it will absolutely exist. And, you know, a really neat summary of culture is it's the way we do things around here. So that's your culture. And your culture is driven very much by the values of the organisation. The values are very much driven by the leaders within that organisation. So remember years ago, So it's that old phrase, monkey see, monkey do. So whatever your leaders are doing, your people will follow. But equally, within a culture, you can have really powerful individuals that aren't leaders that lead culture. And I remember years ago when I was gainfully employed, and there was one individual that was really driving the culture, but quite, wasn't a leader within the business, and really had to get to grips with that individual and involve them in the culture change that we were going through, because they were influencing the people within that department. And you're so right about, you can have different pockets of culture. If you've got different branches, they will have their own kind of unique culture. But you would hope there'd be a series of values. You know, we were focused on your values, weren't we, last Wednesday, or we touched on them. So some of those are actually really embedded. So things like being experts, being pioneering, and then we've got trust, which you've spoken about today, which needs some work on. And so, again, that's where we're moving towards this aspirational thing, and that's okay. But even, you know, even the best organisations, they'll have a beautiful set of values either on the website or in reception or on mugs or whatever it is. Just because they say those are our values doesn't mean that that's the truth, because it can just be words on paper. Yep. It's actually, what are the behaviours that I'm seeing that equate to that value? So, you know, we've spoken about trust today, and there we've spoken about behaviours that mean or equal trust. So being open, being transparent, being careful, or thinking about what we communicate, delivering on promises. So those are the behaviours. And there will be beliefs behind those, but at the centre is the value. But it is complex. And, you know, I spoke about McDonald's, didn't I, last week?
Yep.
And we did a mini SWOT. But it is a great example of when a culture is embedded, it's when you rock up somewhere, do I have a similar experience in Ashby de la Zouche versus Burton-on-Trent, for example? And you would say, from a systems perspective, yeah, you do. But oh my God, if your burger is delivered 5 minutes late, that would be out of culture, wouldn't it? But again, if you remember when McDonald's came over from the States to the UK, I can remember them adopting in Lancaster, you know, up north, them saying, have a nice day, and passing over the paper bag, or lots of plastic as it was back in the 80s. And it just didn't translate. That part of the American culture didn't translate. Although I've noticed that sometimes they do still say that. So it's interesting, isn't it?
I can't believe you ever go to McDonald's.
I do. Well, I've not been able to go recently because of my creaky gold badge. But sometimes Daisy will look at me and say, Mummy, can you not be bothered to make tea tonight? Would you like to go to McDonald's? So.
Well, that's a real clever thing about McDonald's. They hook their customers as children. Happy Meals is the greatest marketing thing in the world. Hook a child, a 4 or 5 year old, and you've got a customer for life.
Exactly.
Genius.
But they're going to have to hook them with the vegan burgers now, aren't they?
Yeah. We'll see. I think it's a fair fad.
Right, I'm going to wrap things up now.
Okay.
So, what's one thing that people get wrong about you?
Probably how I was described last week has been blunt, hostile, and what did she call me? Insufferable. I probably am. I'm not.
But what's the truth? What's the truth?
I don't think I am. I think it's just a front. I think I actually, you know, I care about people. I'm terrified of somebody thinking ill of me. I've worked in bad places before, and yeah. And for bad people before, and I, you know, I'm terrified of putting anybody in that situation, in that position.
Yeah, yeah. I would say you've got a big heart. Right. When you think about success, who springs to mind?
Oh, Christ. Can I think about that? Next question.
Yeah. What's been your best purchase below £100 over the last 12 months?
I don't know. Nothing comes to mind. What have I had? I bought a book by Alice Roberts called Tamed. And it's about 10 species in the world that, you know, rice and corn and cattle and dogs and whatever. And how humans have tamed those different species for our own benefit. And that was completely off the wall, if you like. But actually what it taught me, and I've not forgotten this, is actually about assumptions.
Yeah.
So if you ask somebody, where did dogs come from? Oh, we domesticated wolves.
Yeah.
And actually, she made a very compelling case about actually, did the wolves domesticate humans?
Mm.
I thought, actually, that for me really, really stuck in my head has been, we have an assumption, but actually stepping out of it and going, is that realizing its assumption? And that I just thought was fascinating, to actually turn that completely around into something that seems completely unimaginable.
Yeah. Love it. Love to look out for that one. So what's your biggest insider secret? Do you have any a nugget of genius that you'd like to share? Something that has made an impact on you, perhaps?
Challenge. And stopping and thinking and getting out of just doing your job today. And thinking about what your job is going to be in 10 years, in 20 years, and actually what challenge kind of every assumption, every model that we stick to, every use of language, we call ourselves land agents. And I think that's a really terrible term now. And actually stopping and thinking about all those different kind of things. But then also be sort of putting yourself to the other side of the table and actually understanding the other side of the argument. Because when you understand the other side of the argument, it's much easier to actually get to that middle ground and realizing there are three sides to every story. And actually we've generally only ever see one. We can try and see the other, but actually I think it's very difficult to see the truth in the middle. And so actually working on that, I think, is quite important. There's several.
Yeah, no, I like it. And I love the fact that there's been this theme of truth. Truth, honesty, trust. Throughout the podcast. That's really interesting. So do you have anything else to say? Do you want listeners to connect with you? If so, which is the best social media to connect with you on?
Only on LinkedIn. I don't do any other. Get rid of Facebook. Yeah. was a very positive step. That's a whole other thing. If in doubt, read Estelle's book. Do the workbook that goes with it. And then back it up with some great coaching.
Nice plug, thanks. Thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Pleasure, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to Leader Insider Secrets. You can help this podcast grow by leaving an honest review. Also, if you want to get future episodes, remember to hit subscribe. Finally, if you're interested in working with me, you can book a free 30-minute discovery session, or you can connect and access other resources in the link below. I'm Estelle Reed at B.Company, executive coach, trainer, and author. This has been Leader Insider Secrets.